Okay, there you go. So
does it have enough memory?
I we'll not know. So I really haven't tested it, but I mean, we need to have a scribe in any case. The primary reviewer be the scribe. I was thinking that since the primary reviewer will be, you know, leading the discussion, perhaps the secondary reviewer can be the scribe, and and certainly you can. Doesn't mean that you should not participate while you're scribing. You should participate, but at the same time you have the responsibility to be a scribe. And I if this in fact gets recorded correctly, I can email an MP3 to everyone, so you can go back on the discussion to revise whatever you scribe. So anything that you scribe would go into the comment section. And then what I'll do eventually is, when I prepare the final review, I would take into account the reviews that are posted, my comments and those which were scribed, and, you know, make a cohesive review that I will submit. Okay. Does that make sense to everyone? Mm-hmm. All right. So let's go through, starting from paper number 23, which is, I guess, George's paper,
mm-hmm.
Persistent Shared Heap File System.
Okay.
So Medha, you would be the scribe for this.
So where do we start?
So the idea is that you wrote some review, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if you have a copy of that review.
No, I don't have it printed.
So yeah, it may be a good idea for you to have a copy of the review that you wrote. Yeah, and so that you can go through it.
Yeah, I think it's best if one person prints all the reviews.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Okay, I'm leaving.
Thank you.
Oh, okay.
So, what about the primary reviewer prints the review?
No,
Sajeev is printing all the reviews, so it should be okay.
It's printing all the reviews. I'm printing mine.
All right, that's all right. So, does anyone have questions about how we're going to do this, or is it pretty clear?
The 20 minutes involves the...
Scribe is summarized
for you. The idea that scribe would be not to write each word that is spoken, but rather to note down the high bullets of the discussion, which can go into the review later on.
Okay.
Yeah?
So, I was saying, we constrain the...
Mine's done. I don't know.
The discussion to the 20 minutes, which includes the summary, the presentation of the brief of the paper, and the discussion or, you know, the interaction
86.
With the comments that we wrote.
Right.
So everything fits in the 20 minutes. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So think of this as how you would justify your review, and prepend it with the summary of the paper, and talk about why you had a certain review comment. And go through. You don't need to go through all the detailed comments, especially the 3 and 4 sections where the typos and the related word section may be important. So the typos certainly you can skip easily.
I guess one of the important points you mentioned in the mail is to sort of add or review some comments, like important comments, right, that you sort of missed in the first writing, and then you want to add something, right?
Right.
Like somebody else wants to comment.
Yeah.
An important point.
The other thing is that once we have the reviews, then the secondary reviewer may have added something to the primary reviewer, and so once the primary reviewer goes through all the comments, if the secondary reviewer thinks he missed something, then, you know, you should jump in at that point.
So the secondary reviewer was supposed to add in the primary reviewer's review, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you think he missed out something that,
okay,
you know, that you picked up on, you certainly want to bring that other thing.
Okay, so let's start. Okay, so this paper is basically about, let's see. So the idea is that they motivate the problem by saying that, for instance, the UpdateDB and locate applications are correlated, right? So UpdateDB updates the file system, makes an index of the file system metadata, and then locate reads that database and answers some queries given by the user. So their point is that they have to, in order to do that interaction between those two applications, the system first opens a file, creates some puts it in some structure, and then the other program reads that file in some format and populates this structure. So their idea is that to just keep all that underlying let's say formatting and later reading and populating structure by just storing the actual data. So storing the data structures, right? Instead of making a file. So they create this system called shared heap file system. It is basically a shared memory file system where applications allocate pieces of memory and just put there some binary data, and then other applications can access that data and modify it and do whatever they want. So in terms of the idea of the paper, that's a summary of the paper. The experimental section, I didn't really understand it because I thought it was particularly bad, because they compare against some other system that they never mentioned the other system. So I don't know what exactly they're comparing against.
That's
one point. What?
That's SHMFS. I finally figured out what that is.
Really? Where did they say it?
So SHMFS is another word for TempFS, shared memory file system.
Because they mentioned TempFS a lot of times, but they never mentioned the So the other big issue I had with this microbenchmark is that, for instance, if we see figure 4.4-1, that is the read case, we see that they say that they evaluated with buffer sizes ranging from 1 kilobyte to 2 megabytes.
From 1 byte to 1 kilobyte. Yeah.
Right? So in those cases, we saw that their system always has the same behavior. So it's independent of the buffer size. But we saw that the other file system, the shared memory file system, its performance depends on the buffer size. But they conveniently only evaluate it until that size. And from what it sees here, if you use a buffer size bigger than 1024, probably the shared memory file system will beat in performance their system.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they conveniently
stop there.
Yeah.
Right. So George, before you go into the evaluation part, maybe can you sort of summarize what you think are the contributions of the paper from architecture or design standpoint?
Okay, to answer that question, I'll go to the related work section where they talk about this other work that is SPHDE, that is shared persistent heap data environment. They say it's almost the same, just that the only difference between this one and their system is the semantic, that they use a file semantic and here they use a malloc semantic. So that leaves them with a very, very small contribution in terms of originality of the work. And the other point is that
so just so everyone knows, what ratings did you give for the various categories? Let's start with that first.
Okay, so
I see that you gave a reject for the overall merit.
Okay, I gave a reject.
My number. What is the title?
For novelty, I gave there is an incremental improvement, but it's a very, very small incremental improvement. For longevity, I said that it was average importance. because this one was really, really, I wasn't sure what to put here in longevity.
Longevity means basically means how long will the results of this research be used, and how much impact it will have in the future, how long it will be impactful in the future.
Well,
so would you say not important now or later, or would you say low importance or average and so on?
I would still say average.
Okay. So average because there is
something new, exactly. There is the change of semantics.
Okay.
That's the only reason I would give an average. And what else? And the other thing I didn't like is the actual writing of the paper. So I didn't like the way it's structured. I think that sometimes they spend too much time describing very basic things like how BFS works, and then they spend little time describing their system. And the way that they lay out the paper is also not very good from my point of view. I mean, they could have done a better job there.
So they do go into quite a bit of detail about, for instance, how the various new API elements that they introduce, like MFALLOC, dereference, add name, and so they go into detail of all of the API related.
I think what George is trying to say is that they go into the implementation details, but not so much into the overall, you know, what it should be doing.
Actually, I mentioned that here in the. Exactly what Meta said. That they give a very the BFS description could take away a big part of that and go into a more detailed overview, or let's say a high level overview about how their system works.
Yeah, like
so the only way,
like how they're doing the actual sharing part.
Exactly.
They haven't talked much about that.
Yeah,
I think it's fine because. I think it could be relevant to understanding how it works for template.
They only talk about that part here in the implementation where they say that the restriction for, I don't know if it's a design restriction or if it's an implementation restriction.
So my
comment is that the design of the system is not very well presented. The architecture is okay, but the design itself is not very well presented.
Okay, so but the implementation is also well presented.
The implementation is, it's
I
okay.
I think the implementation has too many details.
So this is what I could gather from this paper in terms of conceptual ideas, right? So the first idea is that they want to build a malloc-like API on top of TempFS.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know what TempFS is, it's basically an in-memory file system that is persistent, but not really persistent across reboots because it's all in memory. But it also uses virtual memory, so which means that some part of the file system can be in swap space. So, but to use this TempFS, you have to use traditional file-like interface. And if you use the TempFS, then any file that you create will be available beyond the lifetime of the process itself. So if the process exists, the file still remains. These guys want to use the TempFS capability to make persistent data structures. So when you malloc and allocate memory, if you map it to a TempFS, then that data structure will be persistent across the lifetime of the process. So that's sort of the basic idea of this paper. Is
why do you need a TempFS?
TempFS already exists. It's a capability that exists in current systems.
Mm-hmm.
What it allows you to do is to retain files that were created by a process in memory beyond the lifetime of the process itself.
Okay.
So you can store files in memory, but of course, since it is in memory, they do not survive a reboot operation or a power failure. The idea is that we use TempFS and add a malloc-like interface to TempFS so that we can create persistent data structures that persist across the lifetime of the process. Beyond the lifetime of the process. So that's one conceptual contribution. The second is that in previous contributions of persistent shared memory and in the case of TempFS, then you create multiple copies of data, of the same data in kernel space and in user space. So they want to eliminate a user level copy. So what they do is use mmap, which is again an existing capability, to map a portion of some data structure which is stored in the tempfs directly to user space memory. So basically reduce the number of data copies that exist. So these are the two contributions that I see for this paper. So there are some things which at the conceptual level need to be clarified, which is not really clarified in the paper, which is first is what are the limits of this approach. The first limit is that the amount of persistent data structures that you can have at any given time depends on, let's say, the size of the swap space. Mm-hmm. So you cannot store data beyond what the swap allows, because this is inherently restricted by virtual memory capabilities and the amount of space that is available there. And I think the other conceptual thing that need to be clarified is what really they mean by persistence. And although they say, well, in our case, the persistent data structures do not survive reboots, the real question is, well, what are the limits exposed because of that design decision, that you build something that does not survive across crashes and failures? So you have to define persistence very clearly and also describe what are the limits that arise when you have that specific definition of persistence. So these are the comments that I had for the paper. So Josh, maybe now you can go into the experiments, or if you've already covered that part, then we can go on to the next paper. Or if someone else has comments, please, this will be the time to talk about it.
Well, yeah, my major comment about the experiments is that they conveniently limit their experiments, the size of the buffer to where they can give a better performance.
One general comment that I have is, I don't see how this could be useful. I mean, how you can use it.
So the motivating application was what George mentioned. Yes. So let's say locate and update DB.
Mm-hmm.
These are cooperating applications.
Right.
But update DB creates a database, mm-hmm. writes it to a file, mm-hmm. and then locate loads that file, creates the data structures. Yes. So if update DB were to write its data structures persistently, then locate can just look up those data structures instead of having to reconstruct them.
Okay.
And update DB doesn't have to serialize the data structures.
Exactly. So here it says that, for instance, using this approach, obviously you have to modify the application, but using this approach, the normal locate takes 1.8 seconds, and using their approach, it takes 0.013 seconds. So that's what? 13 milliseconds. So it's three orders of magnitude decrease in search time. I think this is an extreme case, because it just has to read all the thing, all the database, just for one small query.
And in that specific experiment, they use tempfs versus their.
In this particular, no.
So the question then would be, what if you use tempfs there instead of regular file system?
This is a regular system.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what if you use tempfs instead of what you're doing? Because if you use regular file system, there are no limits on what would be the size of the database that update DB can create.
Mm-hmm.
But in your case, there is a limit that's restricted by size of the swap space.
Yeah. But the thing about this experiment is that it's very convenient. Because Locate is just an application that will load a complete database to query one thing and then exit. Give a result and exit. I mean, it's not like it's going to repeatedly use that. I mean, this is like a very extreme case for them.
So what do you think? I mean, do you agree with George's evaluation of the paper? Is it a reject or it should be more generous?
I don't know.
Okay, well, if there are no comments, then everyone is in agreement. Let's move on to the next paper.
What do you think?
like I have the same comments basically. And even in the micro benchmark, they don't really, like they have this bunch of graphs.
Yeah, but.
Like, what do we understand from these graphs, or what exactly were they doing on these graphs?
So you mean the interpretation of the graphs were left to the reader?
Yeah, interpretation and what it, I mean, they said they could read and write and copy, which is fine, but I didn't get what the speak was. It's something to do with random IO, but I'm not sure. Do you understand what this was? Well, they said they did sequential read writes and random operations.
Yeah, that's the use of LSeq.
So. Yeah, but I mean, the explanation, it just doesn't match.
Yeah, overall the experiments are
so your comment is that the graphs need much more elaboration and better interpretation.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, good. Let's move on to the next paper, which is mixed store, which is, I think, Lewis' paper.
Yeah. So I guess I will start with this, with the paper summary. So the idea of this mixed store is they propose to a new hybrid storage system that takes some conventional HDDs and adds some solid state drive to help this device to have a better performance. Okay, so it proposed two things. The first one is how you optimally select the SSD size given some lifetime. All these parameters are given by the administrator, so you want the lifetime, the throughput that you want, and also I guess here is not, yeah, just
workload.
Those two things and the workload. Yeah, I don't remember that.
I guess the throughput will depend on the workload.
Yes, I guess. I guess one of the variables for the workload, but the administrator has to give that.
You already mentioned lifetime.
So the other component is, after you have all these hybrid systems set up, then there is this second component, which is a dynamic component that takes decisions in what device to use for each of the requests, I guess, or where to store the data that you have in that virtual device. So to do that, I guess to do this scheduling of what to do with this data, they use some kind of a regression to predict the performance that either of these two devices will have. So I guess the contribution of this paper, first of all, is this idea of having an hybrid storage system where you have the help of the SSD to the HDD to have a better performance. And, well, these two components, I think, are the main contribution in how they implement it. I don't know what else.
So the architecture of the system itself, do you think that qualifies as a new contribution, or is that something which is
the architecture
more or less obvious?
There are some decisions. Well, at least we were working something very similar about this. Right? So there are decisions that that at that moment we took completely different. For instance, they proposed to use migration instead of replication, and that was one of my comments. Okay, why to use replication if you can you can assume that the SSD space is small and you actually want the spaces to improve performance, not size, right? But about the, if it's obvious or not, I don't know. I mean, in terms of the architecture, I think they lack in, that's our comment that I have, they lack in precisely say where this is located, because they said that, okay, we modify the firmware of the SSD, we then go to the block layer, and we modify the scheduler, I don't know, something like that. So they are modifying everything. And
so, which is fine. I mean, if you want to have components in the controller, and if you want to have components in the OS, which is fine. But there is a problem which I have, which is they're saying that these two components need to talk to each other dynamically.
Right, the firmware and the operating system, yeah. That's
and the only way to do that would be to extend the command set for any interface that... So which is certainly
true.
Something which is worth examining deeply, how
That's
realistic
true.
It is.
Yeah.
But you can certainly have improvements in the firmware and improvements in the OS if they are independent, and that's realistic.
Sure. Right.
So how do they detect what gets migrated, or no, sorry, replicated, and what doesn't?
Yeah, that's something that I don't remember. I don't know if either of you.
I don't think there's intelligence. I think they haven't
so
elaborated on
a
session.
So what's the difference between using that and just using a hybrid drive?
Well, the hybrid drive is the related work in this paper, and they say that some of the ideas that they developed could also be implemented in hybrid drive. There
right.
is, I don't think, like clear advantage for this kind of architecture.
I mean, yeah, because I mean, I think you could use all of their things and just buy a hybrid drive that have that specification.
Right, but
I
think
formulas and all that.
I
and
think
I'm
one advantage of these over the hybrid drive is that you have the choice to select the size of the SSD. Right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you could use their formulas and functions for calculating and buy a hybrid drive that has that specification.
Right.
And then I don't see what's...
But for that, you need to you need a company that offers exactly...
Yeah, but let's assume Sunny Day. So let's assume that there is a company that offers exactly what you want.
Samsung
and
Microsoft. Yeah, that's the joint company. And the problem with the data approach is that it's static, right? Once you buy the drive, then you have that much capacity of SSD and hard drive. In this case, there is supposed to be an administrator, I mean, wishing some kind of performance with some reliability and lifetime of the device. And he chooses, I mean, he uses this architecture to say, I need this much SSD.
Yeah, but he would still have to change the underlying architecture, right? If the administrator says, okay, now I don't need this what I had before, then I need to buy new hardware. Right, so he would also need to buy a new hybrid drive.
Right,
but
he doesn't trash
the
hard drive, right? I mean, he can reuse the hard drive.
Probably he buys another one also. I mean, I'm only hearing what you guys said, but I think the only real contribution will be the formula, because the other thing is just, I mean, it's just some architecture that supports their formula, but. But if we had, let's say, configurable hybrid drives, then we could implement this. We don't need that.
Well, by configurable hybrid drives, you mean?
I mean that you could say you could get a customizable hybrid drive.
So like I can ask the manufacturer. I mean, I like this.
Yeah, or let's say you have let's say a hybrid drive that has a plug-in for flash memory, something
right.
like that. So you can just put the memory you want there, the amount of.
So George, I think, I mean, there are some valid points that you have, but like you said, the main contribution is probably the modeling of the system itself, right? So how do they create this model? And can you sort of briefly summarize that?
Actually, you know, it's very well that they use some regression model, I guess, they find some, I guess, a part of regression. Well, the thing is, I haven't seen this before. So there are some coefficients, right, that after you have some training, fit in how the or give you some function that tells you how the component the device will behave. Right? I think that's what they do with this regression. But one comment that I have is that, well, at least I don't know if that is common to know, but
One comment that I have is that I didn't understand very well how to use this progression, and that's one thing that I for me was not obvious and probably makes me not understand very well the paper.
Okay, yeah, I can talk about the regression part, but maybe that can be later. I'll reserve my comments for the last. So if you have anything else to discuss, we could discuss that.
Yeah, actually, I made a lot of comments. I don't remember all of them. So, well, one comment that I had is that the figures and graphs are not well explained, and some of them I think they're almost useless. For instance, there are these graphs that where they get some numbers and they say this is how the disk behaves, but they don't, for instance, mention where they got those numbers. Right? There are even figures that are not referenced, and I didn't understand what they were about.
So did you list which figures were not referenced in your?
Yeah, actually, I think was two figures. So the first one is figure 6. I think it's not referenced. And the other is that in figure 8, there are two figures that are B. So I don't know which one are they talking about when they say figure 8B.
which one?
Figure figure 6.
No, I guess this is C. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they never reference to C?
No.
So probably.
Oh, the other thing which I wanted to ask, in table 2, they have a Cello 99 trace, which says that was one of our workloads.
Yes.
Is that ever used? I couldn't.
No, I think it's not used.
Cello 99 is not here. This one. No, this one. This one, no? Cello 99.
Yeah, but that's the one that's not referenced.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, they always mention the financial and the TPC H, but they never mention Cello 99. Or I think they do.
Yeah, so maybe you want to check that. Can you check if Cello 99 is referenced and see if... So what was your rating for this paper?
For this paper, I think it was a week accept.
Week accept. Okay.
Right.
So, I
thought the idea was good. The
model,
the
you didn't
model that they didn't understand seems to be good. Right.
So can you talk about the model?
Okay. Yeah. So the model is they experimented with multiple linear regression first, which is basically a model which is a linear combination of some parameters to predict a certain value. So you have some value that you're trying to predict, which is in this case, let's say performance,
mm-hmm.
bandwidth, latency, whatever. And this is a linear model
mm-hmm.
where you have, let's say, n parameters, and AIs are your coefficients of
mm-hmm.
each of these parameters, and there is some error. So this is simple linear regression where your dependent variable is a combination of some.
So they want to find the AI, the coefficients.
Yeah.
Yeah, the goal is to find the AIs, but more importantly, how do you identify the XIs first?
Mm-hmm.
Because to create the model, you need to know which parameters are the independent variables that influence this dependent parameter.
And how do you train this? I mean, you need some training set or some verification set?
So you certainly need training. Okay, so which is what they did with their generated workloads. They used the generated
mm-hmm.
workloads to train this model. And the XIs, the parameters that they identified are 5 parameters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the 5 parameters are average read-write ratio.
Okay.
Spatial locality in the form of average sequentiality of requests, average inter-request arrival time, average request size, and flash utilization, which is the tricky part of
mm-hmm.
of this. And what they do is that they run some workload, an arbitrary workload, where they change all these parameters.
So they can change each of these, control each of these parameters, request size, read write ratio, and all that. So finally, they get some performance.
What is flash utilization?
Flash utilization is, they define it as the ratio of the working set divided by the size of the flash. That's the utilization of the flash. So only you access only 20% of the data on the flash, then your utilization is 20%. So that's the utilization. So the idea is that by changing these parameters, I train my model. Eventually, when I see real parameters for a real workload, I would know how to get the performance. The problem I have is a simple assumption that they make, which is that the workload is entirely directed to the flash. But they want to use this model in a mixed store environment, where the workload to the flash is just a fraction of the total workload, and in fact, it is changing based on how the dynamic controller behaves. Now, how it makes decisions about which IOs to direct to the flash and which IOs to direct to the disk. You cannot use this model for predicting a workload where only a fraction of the workload is going to flash. So that's, I thought, was a fundamental problem with how they model the system itself. It's because they fit the model assuming that the workload is entirely serviced by the flash device.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing else. So
I see.
So that was one problem I had with how they create this model. So by the way, they realized that the linear model doesn't really work well. So they use something called log linear model, which is just modified this way. Okay. So the log of the performance is a linear combination of certain independent variables, and they saw this model actually fit their training data better.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, once again, I mean, that's nice. I mean, it's good to see how, what would happen given a workload when the entire workload was addressed to the flash, but that's not how they're using it. They're using it in a situation which is different. So you cannot use this model. That's my first comment.
Okay, so that means that the results that they have saying that you need these size of the SSD was
based on the entire workload.
Exactly. So that means that would be the performance if the SSD was the only one used.
Exactly. It's not a mixed store anymore.
No.
It's a flash store. So they're creating a model that they are incorrectly applying to.
I didn't understand that.
Okay. So.
Okay. That's good.
So that was one comment.
It's different.
The other thing, okay, which this may not be the biggest problem. I think the other bigger problem I had was two other problems, which was one was they did not address data partitioning. Like someone, I think both of you pointed out that if I have my data, how do I split them across the disk and the flash? That part is they are completely silent on. So they don't even want to talk about it. They say, okay, let's say we have some data, then I'm going to choose where to send my request, which I think is a very important myth that that they did not address. And another thing is that while they are talking about all the randomness of the writes, right, how the randomness of the writes is going to impact both performance and the lifetime, and so they are trying to control the randomness of the writes. There is existing work. We know that managed flash technology already exists, and when you use something like that, you convert all your random writes into sequential writes for the flash. So in that sort of a situation, how does your capacity planning formulation change? And if there is something like MFT, you're much better off using MFT than. And a similar comment I have for the other paper with flash as well.
Yeah, one comment I have regarding the partitioning of the data is that they mentioned, at least I understood, that they have also some regression model to predict the performance that either of these devices will have with some request, right? So one thing is that I think, probably they don't mention it as they have to, right? But I understood that they will redirect the request, for instance, write request, right? For the device that have the lower latency. So, yeah, but probably it's not well explained.
But you can only do that if you have a choice. And if there is no choice, which means data only exists in the drive, you have to send it to the drive. So the choice really depends on how you do the partitioning in the first place, right?
Right, but the thing is that they have their choices in the writes, right? I mean, you could redirect the writes.
Okay, yeah. For writes, you do have...
You have the choice. And I think that's what they are talking about. They're not talking about reads.
Okay.
Actually, in the reads, they said that...
That makes sense.
Reads requests are always serviced from the device which contains the data.
Okay. So what's happening here is that you do not have any data originally in the flash at all. So the flash is empty. Let's say all
Correct.
Data is on disk. And then you start sending data to flash.
Exactly.
But then that's... Now a little bit more makes sense to me, because if you send only writes to flash, then you create your model based only on write traffic of the workload. And then
right.
the model actually
exactly.
model actually works. Because
what model? The second
the model here, so which I said that you cannot really apply, you can in fact apply if you're directing all write traffic to the flash, then you could use this model.
Right.
But you also have read traffic.
But you
to
also have read. Exactly. That's
you
a problem.
You also have read traffic to address.
And that's
so,
a problem.
So yeah, that's an issue. So yeah, you cannot really apply a model created by the vanilla workload to a modified workload. So
mm-hmm.
I think that problem still exists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So why not talk about MFT and do something very a simple optimization where you have to automatically get the benefits of eliminating random writes
uh-huh.
and not having to deal with them in the first place, right? So because a lot of the modeling is based on how do we model the effects of random writes. The third thing, there are a couple of other things which are probably minor, which is how do you why do you want to make the lifetime of the SSD equal to that of the drive? So whenever they talk about lifetime planning, they say SSD's lifetime should be equal to the lifetime of the disk drive, which is 5 years, nominal lifetime. But why should be that the case? I mean, that the economics of disk drives and SSDs are completely different, and their nominal lifetimes as a consequence would be different, right? So why do you want to equalize them? Maybe you're making a wrong economic decision there by allowing them to last only for 5 years or forcing them to last until 5 years given the economics of how the device and its reliability work, right? So that was something which I thought it has to be inbuilt into the capacity planning. You have to take into account what are the economics of the device as well. Okay.
So, well, I have two more comments. So the first one is that they use simulation, and well, I don't know, but I never like simulation. And I say that, for instance, they don't mention how the consistency is handled.
But they do say that reads are always to the up-to-date location. Right?
Yeah, but how do you update the map, right? That's a big problem, for instance, because you have to...
How do you make the map consistent and
exactly.
all?
Exactly, and that's...
But they
are in the consistency, right?
Yeah, but since they're simulating it, I guess what you're saying is that they should also simulate that part.
Exactly. Or well, I'm saying that because they are simulating this, then they are not finding some big problems that you will have in a real implementation, right? Like the consistency, and also I mentioned about how the granularity of the mapping is done, because we have seen that probably if you do it block by block, it's not a good idea. So you have to go to the page level, and at the page level, you have some problems with the splitting of the request and so on.
So that part, I partially agree with you. I think what they need to do, I mean, since they're not doing implementation, they cannot talk about all these details because it would be meaningless. I don't really implement. So why should I talk about all these fantastic problems, right? But what they do need to do is to simulate the effects
of those behaviors. So for instance, if I need to keep my map persistent in my simulator, as I'm simulating my workload, I should also simulate those extra writes that need to happen to keep my map data persistent, right? So that would be a valid comment. I mean, do you simulate that? At least you don't talk about it.
Okay.
So if you do, you should specify that in the paper.
Yeah, and my other comment, I guess, is a general comment about the SSD and this e-read system is that, okay, so you're spending money in buying a new solid-state drive, right, to have a better performance. But what about buying more main memory, have more cache, right, and in that sense you will have also more increase in the performance, or increase in the performance. So why not to do that? Why not to buy memory and buy instead an SSD and implement a reverse storage system like this?
So buy more memory, buy SSD and disk.
No, no, I'm saying instead of buying SSD,
buy more memory.
Buy more memory, and probably you have the same increase of performance. Right.
Right.
It may not be available.
Yeah. Exactly. Maybe it's a storage node.
Yeah.
So you have.
But even in a storage node, if you add memory to that storage node, you have more cache, right? And having more cache, that means you could have.
But more cache does not mean persistent cache. So
right.
If you don't need to do writes, if it's then cache does not really help all that much.
But I mean, if you have more cache, you have more
read performance.
But also, you have more space for write buffer.
Yeah, but if you depends on what sort of consistency semantics you desire. So
that's
if you
true. Yeah.
If you write to disk, you want to write to disk.
Okay. Yeah.
So instead here we can choose to write to flash, but we cannot choose to write to memory because that's not persistent.
Right.
So okay. So yeah, there are some limitations of what you can do by adding memory. And the other reason, of course, is that you cannot buy as much memory as with the same amount of money that you
yeah,
buy flash.
Exactly.
Well, in fact, the car key is usually hard disk, SSD, and then memory, right? So it's the most expensive thing.
Of course.
You want to add to your system is the memory. Let's say just SSD, you can get it in 120 gig, but the same amount of memory is going to cost you. I think there's an order of magnitude.
Right, but what I'm saying is that probably you don't have to add the same amount of memory.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know, right?
Okay.
But probably. You know, by adding just a small amount of memory, you will have the same performance.
Same performance.
Well, I guess
okay.
If you add like the same amount of small amount of NVRAM, for instance, you could store writes and it could be eventually flushed to
the
NVRAM. NVRAM is even more expensive than regular RAM.
I guess.
So.
Yeah. No. Yeah, but like, if you like buy like less than 120 gigabytes of SSD, you can buy a smaller NVRAM.
You can buy I don't know. 3 megabytes.
All right. Okay. So I think we are running out of time. But what do you think? So one thing which as I was going through reviews, I was just looking at ratings, and we have a lot of weak accepts, which cannot happen. So if you statistically think about a 20% acceptance ratio, out of 6 papers, we should accept 1 paper or 1.5 papers.
When I saw that, I thought it was
2 papers at most.
I was like,
so. So that's something we need to think about.
Okay.
Okay. So I would recommend that you think about revising your reviews accordingly. And after discussion, certainly you may have a different opinion as well.
Have a different opinion. Yeah.
Okay.
So the additional points we're scribing over here, we're gonna post them on the comments.
Yeah, post section. It in the comment section, and I will incorporate them as I do my final reviews. So would you say that you would reduce your rating from weak accept?
Yeah.
To what?
To weak reject.
Weak reject. Okay. All right. So let's move on to the next paper.
You reject the paper.
Right? Yeah, I was the only one.
You are mean.
You are mean.
I felt mean. I
was
like. This is like normal first review.
What's that?
It's like normal first review.
Okay, performance model and space allocation for SSD. So that's our next paper.
That's me. So let me just start by, I think the title of the paper conveys a lot of things. They basically work in those two directions. One is a performance model, and the other one is how to allocate space in the SSD. I think, initially I read this as weak accept, but I'm trying to I think I'm going to revise that rating.
Let's discuss it first.
Right. Well, not because of the trend, but because something else I thought after I caught my review.
Okay.
And just two nights before. Okay, so basically the paper proposes to model the performance of the SSD in terms of writes, in terms of more specifically sequential writes. They understand that reads are constant in the SSD, and they treat them as such. So they completely disregard, the read modeling, which to some extent makes sense, because no matter where you place the data, reads are going to be almost guaranteed constant.
Okay. What are they trying to model?
Write performance, the write latency of the IO stream. The second part is after they model that performance aspect, they propose to do some modification to a file system that behaves in the overwrite, that follows the overwrite approach, meaning that every time you update some data in the storage medium, you're gonna immediately do it, as opposed to hold it in a lock or mix it in some buffer cache to later populate the block in a single I/O. And according to their experiments, and this is a real implementation, they improved the performance of many workloads, and the best one was to 1/3. So time was sort of reduced to 1/3 of the call elapsed time, which is a very nice time, but I think it's skewed anyway. All right, so I think that's basically summarized the what they have done in terms of the work. Go back to what I thought as the summary. Just to complement that information, I put some, by mistake, I think, random write performance. It's not really random write what they improve. It's really sequential write, I would say. They haven't really done experiments doing random write. And that's, I think, one of the main pitfalls of the experiment. And the 1/3 performance, the best case that they obtained, it's based on sequential write. Okay, as to the other sections, the cost, the mapping or the model for the performance, for the write performance, it's based on the model of a hard disk write. In the hard disk write, they recognize that there are two main times that lead the performance. One is position and time of the head, and then the actual read time of the data to get. And they replace that position in time by the merges. Again, I mean, reads are not modeled here, so all the time it's writes that they model. The position in time in the disk is replaced by the merge operation, but the merge cost, which you usually incur in an SSD. When you do an update in an SSD, you usually, if it's an update of information, you will either log that update in a free block, and later you will merge that block with the current data to form a new block. So there's a merge cost, which is classified further in two cases. One is switch merge, in which the whole block is replaced, and the other one is the full merge, in which you sort of interleave.
So Ariel, I think we probably do not have time to explain to everyone. Mm-hmm. I think what you might want to do is just talk about the high level, maybe. So you already talked about the conceptual contributions, which mm-hmm. is one is the model for the write performance, and the other is new space allocation scheme for the file system.
Right.
So maybe now you should talk about what you thought were good and bad about these contributions.
Okay. So the good part, I think it's there's a systematic way to allocate space on the SSD. I think that was the most interesting part, based on one observation. Based on the observation if you write sequentially to the SSD, as you increase the request size, you're going to get the same performance, whether it's random or sequential. And I think another pitfall in doing that comparison is that as you are increasing the request size, of course, your random pattern tends to be sequential anyway, because you're writing, let's say, 1 meg, 2 meg, 4 meg, and then that tends to be more sequential than real random. Like, by random, we usually understand something like we are writing 4K or 1K information. So at some point, they figure out that the 4 megabyte is the best, say, chunk to write to the SSD, because you get the same performance for read and for sequential and random. And they use that idea to subdivide the whole space, the whole SSD, into segments of that space, of that size, say 4 megabytes. And the way they propose to allocate space is every time you request space to the file system will allocate one, let's say, block in in the chunk that has the most free space. So that's the change that they have done, or they proposed and experimented in that direction, and they got good results. And what I think it's they use these postmark benchmarks to do to get the results. And I think this is skewed, because they describe this postmark as being a benchmark that will do the one transaction that either it creates a file or it deletes a file. So that means you are doing really a sequential pattern. And once you, the other two type of operations are you append data to a file, which is still sequential, or you read the entire file. So those are the four operations you do in every transaction. So nothing over there shows the real random pattern. So everything seems to be sequential.
But there is a flexible IO benchmark where
you vary the size.
What is the size of the file?
Uh-huh.
When there is a random read and random write percentage.
So
they do have random writes somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I have a question. How do they do simulation or?
No, it's real implementation.
It's real implementation.
It's of the X2, I think the X2 file system is what they modified.
Mm-hmm.
And they compared against the regular X2. And that's where the difference is.
Do they mention, I guess they know that. Do they mention something about the splitting of requests by 12 kilobytes or
no,
the problems that I have?
No.
No?
I think I was chatting with you the other day quickly.
Yeah, because if that is the case, then they are splitting and...
No, but the thing is that none of these benchmarks actually issue more than 512 kilobytes.
Right.
So you're not going to have larger than 512 kilobytes. And if you do let's say you do a 4 megabyte IO request, that the operating system is going to split it up into sequential writes, which you're going to get really good performance anyway.
Right.
So I don't think they actually solve the problem. And they don't need to solve the problem to get the results that they
Right. So, okay. So I guess then what they do is that they discover that by having segments of 4 megabytes and write in those segments sequentially, then you have a better performance.
Right. Yeah. That would be basically the...
Independently of... If you send a 4 megabyte request, or if you just send 4K requests in that block.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
And the problem is that to get to that 4 megabyte formula, or correct size, there's just an empirical way,
mm-hmm.
which they say. I mean, we're choosing this size because at this point we think that, or we feel that, random and sequential I/O for the SSD is
mm-hmm.
the same. Well, I mean, we get the same response time.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that basically the effect that they are seeing is because since they are writing on different locations of the whole space, there's an internal mechanism for optimizing the random writes in the SSD, right? And usually the lock approach is used. So what's happening in the end is that they are using different lock blocks, and most of them are clean because you are really distributing. You are not letting the file system choose any arbitrary position to allocate the next free chunk, right? In each request, so you're using like more free log blocks, so you are incurring less merge costs in the end, and that why they are seeing this improved performance. But nothing is starting. I mean, this, like I mentioned before, they are not only testing random, real random I/O, like small, right, I mean, updating different parts of the single file or multiple files, but really including in this merge. So my feeling is that they improve this by avoiding doing the random write pattern.
So yeah, I didn't quite understand that part. So you're saying that these experiments do not really do random writes?
No, I don't think so. They do. Because here, if you go back to section 6.1,
mm-hmm.
Second paragraph, they say
I understand 6.1 may not be doing random writes, but
6.3.
How about 6.3, which is where they talk about the flexible I/O benchmark, and that's where they talk about random writes percentage. So you're saying that this part also is not doing random write?
No, I don't.
So there is a random read and random write which they mention here, and so this is flexible I/O bench which has been previously been used. This benchmark was test verification provides many parameters that can be set to test various forms of I/O. And so in that case, they have random read and random write as one of the I/O types.
Right. I would need to check again this section, but I don't think they are doing.
Okay. So yeah. So maybe.
And especially the results for the thing is 9. I think it's figure 9. A and B.
We don't have a reference for this flexible I/O.
Yeah. The read,
there is a reference. 5.7, right?
Oh, okay.
It's GenStack's post to FIO, flexible I/O test.
Yeah, but it's after the postmark benchmark.
Okay, in the majority of the write, random write operations in figure 9B took 750 microseconds. And on the original X2, it takes close to 2 milliseconds.
Right.
So that would be the improvement if this is really through random I/O, common sense.
Yeah. And that makes sense because what they're doing is in some sort of primitive logging based approach. And that's why, I mean, my comments about this paper were somewhat different than what you've been talking about. The first is that deletion is not a good. In any file system allocation scheme, you cannot just talk about how new space is allocated. You also, equally importantly, need to talk about how deleted free space is reclaimed and reused. And that part is not addressed at all. And in fact, I think that will be a problem because they always assume that they can write sequentially into the block that is most free. But once you start pulling out, now, once you start deleting files, your blocks become fragmented,
mm-hmm.
and then your free space is no longer available at the sequential end of the block,
mm-hmm.
right? So how do you address that one?
Yeah.
So that was one of my...
can you say that again?
The way they do allocation is, let's say you have a whole bunch of blocks, and they're saying that they're going to always keep filling blocks sequentially starting from the top, and at any given time there will be few blocks which will be written into. And they are assuming that I'm going to write into the block which is the least filled up. Right, that's their...
But I think what they say is they select a block which is the least filled up and then they keep writing to that block until it's full.
Because
that's their focal factor or something.
Right, so you keep writing. Let's say this is your least filled up block, right? So you keep writing it till it is entirely full.
Okay,
but at some point, let's say I have a file in here that I delete.
Okay.
So I have free space in between, in the middle of my block. And over time, as my file gets more and more fragmented, most of my blocks are going to look like this. I no longer have this very nice set of half-filled up blocks.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do at that point?
So you're talking about cleaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need to address cleaning if you want to do any sort of primitive logging approach where you change the location to make it more sequential, you have to address cleaning. And going back to the logging approach, there's already MFT, which is available, right, which basically does exactly more or less the same thing, but at any given time, it writes to only one block rather than choosing from a set of available blocks, which I think is even better. If you always wrote to one block till you filled it up and then went on to the next block.
Well, they have actually the both techniques, right? One is they choose the most free, and the other one is that is the greedy approach, and the other one is to choose one and then fill it up till there's no more free space or there's a threshold like the minimum. They propose both things, and if in their experiments, greedy was better.
Right.
To the first one.
So then this looks like MFT to me. Why don't you compare against MFT, which is, yes, agreed that it's not a file system level approach. In fact, it works with any file system. So you should be comparing with that. And second, you're talking about making logging-based optimizations. So you should compare with log-structured file systems and not with EXE2, right? So these were some of the problems I had. And they say, well, we only address override-based file systems. But what you are doing is not override anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So why are you comparing with something that's override-based file system, right? And that was some of the problems I had with this paper.
One limitation, big limitation of the authors of this paper is that they sort of make some observation on the SSD, and then by increasing the size of this request and writing up to a certain point where they observed it was the same for sequential and random in their definition. And that's all the information they used for taking the decision for splitting or subdividing this large space in smaller chunks, but they little understand about what exactly is going on underneath.
Yes.
And the explanation for the better performance that they got is because they are increasing this focal factor, which has to do with, I have my application, the data of my application is only locating as many field inders as possible from the, you know, in the old traditional disks. So I will minimize this position in time. And they try to do the same here, and they say, we are localizing data because we're choosing one segment and we are filling it up, the data that comes from, let's say, a stream of requests that comes from my application.
But internally, the flash may be doing something else.
They may be doing something else, and from the work that we have done, we know that there's some allocation pools. So in the greedy approach, they are using many allocation pools.
Okay.
So that may be
beneficial. Okay, I think we should stop now because we are running out of time. But what I would like you to do, do you want to revise your review based on the new comments that you had after you had the review?
Yeah.
So
it's 1 point.
Yeah, if you want to add that would be great, because I think what you're saying makes absolute sense, which is at what you see from outside may not necessarily what is happening on the inside,
mm-hmm.
especially in terms of writing and choosing clean blocks and so on. So we should talk about that. Okay, so the next paper is...
Do we review at the end of the thing ourselves? I mean, edit the comments? Or
go ahead and edit the comments, the review. And what I would like the scribe to do is add any comments that you have written down in the comment section, which I can use later on.
Okay.
But if there is something that you want to revise of your review, please go ahead and do that directly in the review itself. So the next one is workout. Okay, so Meera, this is your paper.
Yes.
For this one?
Sure.
Okay.
Right, so in this paper, they propose a technique to improve the reconstruction time in a RAID system after saving it. And they also improve the performance during reconstruction. They use a surrogate, like when a RAID system fails, they use another surrogate RAID system.
Any RAID system?
They use RAID 5.
Well, there are three options.
Yeah, I mean, they propose the options, but then they use rate 5. Like.
Maybe
it's
I don't think it matters. Does it matter?
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
What happens is when there's a failure in the rate system on any of the disks, while the reconstruction is happening on this in the rate system, they use a surrogate rate to which they redirect all the user writes and the popular read requests. And then the gain in performance, the reconstruction times are much shorter because the rate system, the frame rate system does not have to service the user I/O. And again, the user I/O performance is faster because it's all directed to the surrogate rate.
Assuming that the surrogate rate system is faster than the original rate system.
So the surrogate rate system is just a replica of the original rate system?
No.
It's not a replica. So yeah, a lot of things which I didn't understand about the surrogate rate system. So let's go.
So what was your rating for this paper?
Overall merit was weak, except novelty was 4 because it was actually between 3 and 4, so I just gave it 4. I wasn't sure. Longevity was 3, and
And the maximum value is 5, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Best value is 5.
Yeah. It's not necessarily used only in the reconstruction time. It can also be used for any task which rate performance, which can impact performance, like scrubbing or rethink or anything, basically, doing any of these. The comments I had was in the architecture section, it could use this more explanation, especially with the surrogate rate system. It wasn't clear. So they mentioned that the same surrogate rate system can be used by different degraded rate systems, right? But it wasn't clear what information is exactly stored to identify which parts or which sections of the surrogate rate system is used by what degraded rate set.
So would it be as simple as I'm going to create several volumes, one for each degraded rate set?
They say that the implementation and evaluation of that is not, it's work in progress. At the end.
In the
so, No. In the design. Page 5.
So it's, I guess one of the assumptions is that you typically, the probability of two rate systems getting degraded at the same time, they're assuming that to be small. So perhaps you have at most two degraded rate systems using the same surrogate, but probably not more than two. And in the normal case, usually one at most, or none. Right. So I think that's sort of the underlying unsaid assumption, which probably they should be spelling out.
Right. Then they also mentioned that the degraded rate, there's some space allocated to the surrogate rate system on the, but. And the space can be increased later if required, but they don't mention how to, how the space is managed if it has to be increased.
So you're saying that if you need more space than is allocated in the surrogate rate.
So more space can be allocated, but they don't mention how this additional space is allocated. And then they also mention. That user writes are redirected to the surrogate rate, and popular reads are also redirected to the surrogate rate. So are these popular reads to the writes, or are these popular reads to the whole rate system? In that case, is the rate a replica of the original rate system, or?
I think they talk about that very clearly.
I think the reads are, if you read something twice or more, that's a popular read.
They keep this LRU list.
So everything that is in this LRU list is
right. So if you read something more than twice from the degraded rate, it's copied to the
surrogate rate,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But then, what would be the performance like, even then you have IOs coming into the degraded RAID, which...
So you're saying what is the performance impact to the...
For the read,
for the other read.
Yeah, but that's, I guess all of that is included in the evaluation, right? So they are, somehow they, over time they say that, well, once we have all the popular data, then in the surrogate, then the surrogate does not have to bear any additional responsibility or does not have to bear any additional role, and the degraded set can focus completely on the reconstruction. So there is a certain warm-up or boot-up period, the way I understand this, is during which time you move data from the degraded RAID set to the surrogate, and all writes, of course, go to the surrogate directly. And then after a period of time, the surrogate becomes more and more used, and the load slowly gets transferred from being mostly to the degraded set to mostly to the surrogate set.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I guess the point is that you do not want to increase the load on the degraded RAID while maintaining acceptable performance on overall for foreground I/O.
And one more thing I wasn't very clear about is what is the stripe split between the degraded RAID and the surrogate RAID? What happens then?
They mentioned that they say that they just split. They put the portion that is on the surrogate to the surrogate and the other one to the other one. You mentioned that here at some point.
So
what about the parity consistency of that?
Well, they just split the I/O. Just the part that is in the surrogate, they give it to the surrogate, and the parity consistency is handled by the surrogate, and the other part is just handled by the other.
So later on, when you do move back the data from the surrogate into the original RAID, at that time, the original RAID will recompute the parity.
Exactly.
But yeah, there may be something there. I mean, I haven't thought deeply about that. There may be some situation where you may lead to parity pollution or something like that. I think that needs to be carefully considered. That some part of your stripe is stale, and are you going? The question is, are you using that stale for subsequent computations? Actually, you will not use that because that will get redirected to the surrogate.
Exactly. It's in an upper level.
Yeah, it's in an upper level. Okay.
Yeah,
but except if you're doing, it depends on where you're doing this. If the controller is doing something internal.
Well, we see that here, right? So that's before. That's in the reconstruction.
All of this is inside the controller.
Exactly. All of this is inside the controller.
So that makes my vision of this system completely different, because they assume that the same RAID controller is going to address the degraded set as well as the surrogate set. But if you want the surrogate set to be shared across multiple RAID systems, all of those RAID systems must dangle out of the same RAID controller. Otherwise, you cannot use the surrogate.
Yeah, that's
a good point. So this architecture is flawed. And or at least not consistent with the rest of the description that they say where the surrogate will be used across multiple, or maybe they are talking about this being a really large scale system where you have, let's say, like some big NetApp box where you have multiple RAIDs inside, and let's say maybe 100 RAID systems inside this big wardrobe-like storage system, right?
Actually, I always thought it was like that, but you're right. The architecture is different. I always thought it was like you had a whole bunch of RAIDs, and then you had this surrogate RAID somewhere else, and you really...
Yeah, I was looking at a storage area network kind of
thing. Yeah, exactly. Something like a SAN, but this is more like just local RAID.
Yeah, it's like some high-end storage system that you could do this with, but... I mean, you could apply the same technique with a storage area network kind of environment, right? Why not?
Actually, it would have better results, because here you're saying, I'm not sure. Because you can use the same surrogate RAID for many, many, but then the interaction is different because each RAID controller will have to
interact with
the OS.
So that's a little, it's a little tricky how this system is going to be architected. I'm not saying that the contribution becomes diminished or anything, but certainly there is confusion how this works. If it's a large box, then I guess it's fine. They're assuming that it's one large box, and maybe they are because they have all these dots in between.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so maybe they do assume that there are several RAID systems within that is dangling off of the single controller, which is this high-end controller that can do workout, right? And if that's the architecture they're targeting towards, it's fine. It's just a specific architecture. It doesn't generalize to network attached storage.
Okay. One more thing to mention that in the reclaim process, they first delete the entries from the log, and then they write it back to the recovery.
What log?
The data structure. The
table.
Yeah. So they delete it from.
So they first delete it from the table, and then they write.
I didn't understand that also.
So.
And they do the write operation.
Yeah, to the reconstructed RAID from the surrogate RAID.
Okay.
So whatever from the surrogate RAID is also in the data structure, right? So they first delete the entry from the mapping from the map, and then they copy it back to the surrogate RAID, which I'm not sure is the best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to be careful about how you do that. Is your point?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you want to, if you are concerned about that, you should specify exact scenario where that will break. What if a write comes, and then you do this, and another write comes to the same block, and this is what is going to happen.
Fine.
So you need to spell it out in your review.
Okay. Well, actually, if another write comes, that doesn't, it's fine. But what if the system fails or something?
Yeah.
If another write comes, it goes to the
reconstruction. Whatever it is. The scenario has to be described, because you cannot just say, this doesn't seem right. You have to specify some scenario which gives the author some intuition about what you're thinking. Okay, so
I think that's
it. Okay, so any other comments about this? So what rating would you give for this paper?
Me?
Yeah. Based on whatever you heard.
I don't know. I don't know.
You have to read the paper before you commit anything. So, George, you read it, right? What was your rating?
I would stick with math rating of week and
six. Accept.
Yeah.
Okay. And and what was missing to not give it an accept or a strong accept? Was the idea too simple, or
no? I mean, there are some things about the architecture for me that are not clear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main reason I would give it a weak asset.
So if you assume that this is all a one high end box, you're doing workout inside this high end box, then does that architecture make sense? Because it seems like from this figure that's what they're doing. This figure is more or less clear where they have the surrogate set is not outside the system, it's everything is inside one system.
So to me, using the idea of the surrogate RAID system itself is not very appealing. I mean, I don't know.
No, for me that was the most appealing, actually, because,
with a surrogate RAID system,
I mean,
you have additional costs in the space. And
yeah, but, I think they make a good point for the improvement or the reduction of reconstruction time. They talk about since these are getting bigger, reconstruction time is also growing. And the probability of having another disk failure increases by increasingly, I think more than linearly by the amount of time that the RAID is degraded. So they make a good point for that and
yeah, the previous paper they talked about this hazard rate, right? I mean, a
when you think about hazard rates, you automatically get
paranoid.
You're in some hazard mode.
Well, actually, I thought it was a good idea. So, I don't agree with you in that.
Especially with the same controller controlling all the ways. I mean, if you have like a big system with...
But isn't that what NetApp sells? I mean, NetApp sells one of these big...
Exactly, it gets managed somehow.
Yeah.
Big, like...
Actually, I thought this was from NetApp.
Could be, I mean, I won't be surprised.
Could be. I didn't
know. No. I mean, no. I'm not.
Yeah, you can say.
But actually, I thought that was a good point. I mean, if you could just use one RAID for multiple reconstructions, multiple RAIDs that are degraded at a time, I think it's. I mean, it's not a big cost if you have, let's say, 100 RAIDs and one surrogate RAID.
But only for a very.
It's only 1% of the cost.
Yeah, but only for like big storage systems like that.
Yeah, but assuming that it's a big storage.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
I assume that you had at least, I don't know, 20 RAIDs connected there.
Yeah, that's
something like that.
Because it's not only for reconstruction.
I mean, if you have one RAID and one surrogate RAID, it doesn't make much sense. Yeah, for that case, I probably the best option would be this live surrogate RAID set. So when they use part of the space on the other one to do it, but. But I think the idea is very good. The evaluation is also good. I mean, I think but here my point is that they compare against Pro and PR, but I think WorkCat could be used in combination with Pro and PR.
That's right.
I think that's what they do.
No, I don't think they do that.
It could be faster with Pro and PR.
Yeah, I mean, these are not really competing techniques, but workout with Pro or PR will be even faster than just workout alone.
That was my only problem with the evaluation.
Show that in the worst case, you will get so much of improvement.
So after
that's
this,
basically the point of this.
Right. So after this discussion, is your architectural concerns addressed?
No.
No.
I still have some holes. For instance, they redirect all the write traffic to a surrogate RAID.
Mm-hmm.
So
also some reads.
So my question is why don't you just when you're reconstructing the degraded set and you know that something is in the surrogate RAID, why don't you just read it from there instead of reading the other ones and calculate the parity and all that?
Yeah, that could be an improvement, but the disk head may not necessarily be there.
No, here it will be. For this one, you will just incur the cost of reading here. Well, I mean, there are a couple of design issues I don't agree with.
It's more complex, is what you're saying.
Yeah,
you could make it more complex if possible.
Yeah, I think you can tune it up a little more than
the real question is there enough for a paper that will appear in FAST? Would you be surprised if you saw this paper in FAST?
No,
I guess
because
not.
I think the evaluation of it is pretty good.
Okay. I think I have my answers then. So my rating was, this was the only paper which had an accept. So I didn't have a weak accept. I had an accept for this paper because I really could not see any problems. And after the discussion, I still cannot see any major problems.
Yeah.
And it seemed like there was some simple problems, but those are just minor comments.
I
thought they had a really good evaluation.
Yeah.
And
the evaluation.
And they also did sensitivity analysis, right? So which was quite impressive.
So you give these guys an accept, right?
Yeah.
So, and you said that they have a good evaluation and they have very good stuff. So what does it take to have a strong accept?
Something really new and normal, I guess.
I mean, this could have been a strong accept as well, because the reason I didn't give it a strong accept because I didn't see the remaining six papers in my pool. Now, certainly, I want to give one paper a strong accept among all the papers that I read, and maybe one paper an accept.
Okay.
Just based on the ratios of how many papers do get accepted into FAST.
And assuming that the distribution of papers is completely random, everyone should have approximately 20% of papers that they think should be accepted.
Okay.
So yeah, once I have the next six reviews, done, then maybe this would be promoted to a strong exit.
So your decision is based on the six papers we discussed today.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's right.
So this could also be rejected from the next set.
Which one?
Yeah, if we get two really good ones, in the next one we can.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't want to be, I mean, it could be just that you are skewed. I mean, this paper, I certainly don't have any problems with, and I don't have any problems accepting it, even if there are two other papers which are strong except.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think just because, sorry, that would just mean probably that the papers that were assigned to me were skewed.
Mm-hmm.
And someone else got every, all papers were really bad, and they rejected everything. So someone has to compensate for that, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, I tried to, when I chose the papers to review, I chose papers which I thought would be good papers and well-written papers, so that we don't waste our time reading junk, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but regardless, most of the papers are good, and you still have to stick to that 20% ratio.
Yeah. Yeah, but this one is, I think we should move on.
Yeah, let's move on.
You're allowed to accept any number of papers, or in your city, you're allowed to accept any number of papers.
Yeah, but I'm not making the final decision. The final decision would be made at the program committee meeting, based on everyone's review.
Right.
It's like a democratic thing, like everybody votes.
I just get a vote, and then the final vote would depend on the final decision would depend on all
votes. So it's tactical.
All right, let's move on. Okay, Ricardo, you're next.
Okay.
Talking about HydroStore.
Okay, so this paper describes a new storage system, a new commercial storage system by NEC, which is called HydroStore. We're not supposed to know them, but...
Oh, by the way, I just changed you. I changed a lot of your review.
Yeah, no, I was reading, Yeah, I was accepting when you were rejecting this. Yeah. Okay, so the thing with this storage system is that it's they propose the complete stack, which they divided into layers. One is they call the backend, and the other is the front end. The idea is that the backend exposes a content address storage, which block storage, which provides duplication, failure tolerance, and according to some experiments, the read write performance of this backend increases linearly with the number of nodes. And in the front end layer, you're supposed to build modules like file systems, for example, that use this backend interface. So, for example, for your concern, if you want to provide a typical position, a block position in an interface, you have to build your module that uses the content based interface, and then maintains the mapping, which they can use to. No,
which concern?
Remember, you're saying in a paragraph that you're looking in the paper for some explanation of the mapping from content address storage to block based.
Right.
To position based. I mean, that, I assume you'll have to build a module that maintains that mapping, but that's not a concern of the backend.
That's not a concern of the backend.
Yeah.
No, but the backend is doing deduplication. And
yeah.
And then it needs to, the backend does not do allocation, you're saying?
No, the backend has to expose the position to the front end, and the front end maintain the mapping.
So the front end is doing all allocation.
Yeah.
I see.
I mean, but I'm not sure. The thing with this paper is that these kind of things are not explained. You have to somehow guess. That's the main issue. Another issue is that we know that we've seen a lot of projects using content address storage and the duplication for offline storage, for example, Foundation or Venti. The issue we're seeing on those is that the duplication and content address storage reduces data locality. You know, but for example, a long file reading
being written to the storage system can be divided in several places, because this is a copy of this, this is a copy of that. So sequentiality is lost, data locality is lost, so the effectivity of caches decreases, and the speed of reading this will also decrease. So they somehow address this issue by, for example, if you divide your long originally sequential access into several pieces and distribute the pieces to different bits, you might doing better. But what happens if you have a much more segments in this sequential axis than you have nodes? So there must be a crossover point where your performance starts decreasing. That's actually our concern. I guess you have the same issue, right? That's
the fragmentation problem.
Yeah.
And for dedupe and other kind of storage where you need, for instance, cleaning up is extremely hard because you cannot just go and delete something.
Exactly.
You have to find out, well, what are the references and where those references point to and so on. So you have to do multi-path cleaning operations when you want to reclaim space. And one of these passes, as they propose, is read-only. And that can take as long as 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So basically your storage system is frozen for 30 minutes. You can do only read operations. You cannot do any write operations. In online storage, that's unacceptable. So you can do that for backup and offline storage. You cannot do this with online storage. So they're sort of trying to merge, which is actually a great approach, which is to merge offline storage with online storage and have only one to deal with. The management is significantly simplified. You don't have to deal with other offline backup storage. Everything is in one place. But I don't think they address the challenges that need to be addressed to make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's the main question you have, right? I mean, you're decreasing. You might be decreasing performance for some workloads, or you might be increasing the performance, but you don't know. The experiments don't show that. Don't answer that question. At least they don't answer the question. So without that question and answer, I mean, we are just as before. We have reading. We were reading. We don't know the. I mean, if using content address storage for online workload is good or bad. But my answer is that if it's NEC and this is a commercial storage, it has to be good. So this should go to
not
the world.
Necessarily. I mean, there's a lot
point.
Of junk out there in the commercial domain. I mean,
it's Windows.
There is a lot of junk out there. I mean, it doesn't mean that. Regardless of whether it's good or not, maybe it's good, but we are only evaluating the papers.
Yeah.
We are not evaluating a commercial product. We didn't even look at the commercial product,
yeah.
Right? And we don't even know how it performs. So how can we assume behaviors and properties of the commercial product when evaluating something different, which is a technical document?
And also, there are some really great ideas that they mentioned they are using, but they don't specify how. For example, the idea of if you are addressing the if you are using the duplication, the idea of how big or smaller your blocks is very important, because the smaller your blocks, you have higher amount of duplicated content, but you have more metadata and stuff. So they
and
say
more
they
fragmentation
have, and more fragmentation.
Right.
So they have a dynamic changing of the block size, and also they can have multiple block sizes working at the same time on the system. They say they have that, but they don't say how.
Yeah.
Which maybe it's because it's commercial and they don't want to give a secret. But I don't know. But that would be nice to know.
No, but that's
very useful. To
yeah, me. If your priority is commercialization and trade secrets, why do you want to publish a paper?
Yeah,
that's a good point.
Yeah.
Go patent it and then come out with all the details. Because then,
later on,
yeah,
if you want to publish something,
yeah, I mean, for me, it was just this paper was one of the hardest to read. The most hard was the next one, actually. but this one was also pretty hard because it just has so many ideas which are not explained. Some of them are not even explained at all.
Yeah, Yeah.
Okay, just say, okay, here's what we do. There's a magic. When you wrote in your review magic, I had the same word in my comments, magic.
Yeah.
Okay, this like seems like magic to me.
But they don't say amount. Yeah.
See, load balancing works beautifully, but they don't say how. Yeah, beautiful, that's great, but tell us a little bit about what you do.
Also, all the issues that they explain the idea of IO requests and scheduler queues and all of that. Everybody in storage uses the same term. But they're using new terms. For example, IO request, they call it a synchron.
What? IO request a synchron?
A synchron. And a lot of stuff like that that makes it very hard to read it.
They want it to be fancy.
Yeah. Yeah, but even, I mean, I don't feel rejecting this is fair. I feel that there's something. No, really.
You're a real optimist, actually.
No, really. I mean, there are a lot of good ideas that maybe we are not. Maybe.
No, but I'm not
explaining.
You know, I'm not saying that this system does not get to be published. It should be published, but not in this form.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you can publish something in this form, right? I mean, you have to do a much better job of writing about your system, and then it will get published.
Yeah.
If the reader cannot understand what your system is doing, then why should it be published? And anyone who reads this paper will be in the same position as we are.
Yeah.
So it's taking up, 14 pages of the proceedings of a highly prestigious conference. For what? For nothing, right? So, I think we had to be, certainly, I see why you are thinking that we should accept this paper because, well, they have a commercial product, this thing works, but that's not the basis for accepting a paper for a research conference. And I certainly feel that they probably are pressured to do other things,
so
fix bugs and get the next release out, and they don't have time to write a good paper. But
so probably if you didn't know it was NEC, you would have rejected it.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
See, yeah. So you were biased.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, but it's that kind of paper that makes you feel, first it makes you feel stupid because you're not understanding that the first read, you have to read it many, many times.
Yeah.
Because they have billions
of terms. I think that's not your fault. I mean, you as a writer, you have to be sure that the reader understands what you're writing.
You don't know. Now I don't know if some terms I just couldn't get them or it's not explained. I don't know.
Right, but it's responsibility of the writer, not like you are stupid.
Yeah, absolutely true. I felt like maybe this is some other area or something. I'm not in this area. I was reading this paper. There's just so many new terms. And
yeah.
I mean, even if it were a new area, I probably would understand more terms of a new area than what I understood of my own area. So.
But probably we can use some of those terms in our paper.
Yeah.
Yeah. If they define it and they
want to get rejected.
Okay. So Ricardo, your recommendation was a weak accept, right?
Yeah.
And mine was actually started with a reject, but then since I had to be something which is between the two of us, I put it as weak reject.
Okay.
So let's go to the last paper.
You know, 10 minutes. Right?
Yeah, 10 minutes.
It was really quick. So the paper is not just a log and activity for the journaling. First I will describe the scenario of the paper they're talking about. So what does the current journaling file system do? So the current journaling file system is only used for recovery. And for recovery, it works really well. But there are some performance degradation which is associated with this recovery thing, with the journaling. The thing is that whenever you in a journal, you first write to the log and then checkpoint it later. So there is an extra write associated with each write operation. If so, first, then we have three types of write journaling operations. So we have data mode operation, we have metadata operation, that is ordered mode operation. So in ordered mode, we only write metadata. So by this way, we are really decreasing the amount of journaling write we have to do anyway. But now recent studies show that even the metadata operations are really a bulk of write operations we usually observe. So for example, the postmark, which just creates a delete file. Most of the structure creates a delete file. All of this does require metadata write operation. So for each of the metadata write, we have to first write to the journal and then again to the disk. So there is extra write for every write operation. So what it actually counts? So for example, when user is running a normal read operation, write user is not really concerned with, but read is more concerned from the user's perspective. So this extra checkpointing write operation really interacts with normal read operations from the user's perspective, and that severely degrades the system performance. Because for normal journaling, all the journal location is fixed. It's the first allocation group of the entire disk block. So you have to move your disk arm from where you are to the beginning of the disk block. So this is a really strong overhead. So what this paper talks about, that it comes with a new mode of journaling, that they want to use journaling more often than it is used nowadays. So they call it active journaling. So in active journaling, they use some of the benefits that we can have from the journaling itself, and they have its own new implementation, new observation. So in active journaling, the journaling location is not fixed. So for each block allocation group, it has its own journal group. It has its own journaling location. And this journal location is really not fixed. For example, it's just a linked list of blocks, basically. So now, when you really want to commit a transaction, you just see that my disk arm is at position somewhere. So I will write it to the closest location if possible. So this is the new mode of journal. You don't have to go back to the original AG0 or block allocation group 0. So you just write closest to where the disk arm is. So there is one advantage. Another is that whenever we write it to a journal, the block is the current version of the write operation. So it's the fresh data, it's the last updated data. So for read operation, we can just use the journal block itself. Not we have to go to the exact location where the block is checkpointed. So we can use the journaling block itself to get the data block for the read. And another thing they implemented is that they use the concept temporal locality. For example, you are having a bunch of requests, and there is a temporal time differences between the accesses. So if we see that the temporal locality is not matched with the spatial locality, so for example, you have disk access X and disk access Y within a small time gap delta T. So, but this X and Y are really sparse. But you are visiting it more often, this temporal locality. But this temporal locality doesn't match with your spatial locality. So what will be the usual with best case scenario? We want to find a way so that the X and Y should be closely located because it are accessed more closely in a time difference. So that also they talked about in their new journaling mode. So in their journaling mode, they use a VMAP data structure, so what they call the virtual checkpointing, where the data is not really checkpointed. So they just use a block of set of linked lists, a set of blocks, and used all of these blocks for versioning. And another main thing that in this case, the size of the journal is not fixed. So if you have more free space, you can use as many space as you want. But later when you have space crunch, you can reduce the amount. You can, I think, for data blocks, for less important blocks, they use that you just use two. And for high importance blocks, that is a super block or something, use more versions. So that is the main concept of the paper.
So you are certainly impressed and sold on this paper,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because I see you give an accept.
But the main drawback of the paper is that they didn't implement anything.
That was the final.
No, but
so you saved that comment for the last. Very good.
So what did it do?
Fine print.
No.
He was impressed with the story, right?
No.
I mean, who was impressed with the story that Sajeev gave right now? You were impressed with
yeah,
that?
Yeah,
you were impressed?
Cool, yeah.
impressed.
Okay.
Right?
It sounds like a lot of
differentiation. No, there's
okay.
differentiation.
Were you impressed with the story that Sadiq was...
With some minor comments, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. It's pretty impressive. I mean, you sold the paper really well. So yeah.
You're a co-author.
No, but that's, I mean, if I were to argue for in favor of this paper at, let's say, the program committee meeting, this would be, like, what I would do. I mean, it's exactly the right thing. So yeah, okay. So,
yeah, the main drawback is that they use the simulation to justify their approach. And the thing is, the main difference is that they didn't, because the paper is a collection of a bunch of new techniques, they didn't justify each of them separately. And they just evaluated, I think, the random write performance, or random write performance that, or the random operation that they were certainly improving by this temporal locality concept. Yeah, that's the main thing. That the evaluation is not at all strong in this paper, but I think the design is really good.
I
think it's a really new contribution. But
yeah.
But they I think they, at the end they say that they will try to implement it later. I guess.
Okay, so one of the comments I had is that, yes, these ideas in isolation seem good, and especially the fact that you don't really need to checkpoint, which I thought was quite interesting. I mean, if you have a journal that can be really large, or you just store the data in the journal itself, why do you have to move it back to the file system, right? The reason that data needs to be moved into the file system in the original journaling file systems is because the journal is of limited size. And you need to reclaim space, so you need to move stuff back into the static file system location. Here,
another thing, the
arbitrary size, so you can just leave it there. You don't need to bring it back into the static file system. So the question is, I mean, what happens after a while? I mean, your original file system is completely gone. I mean, your original file system structure does not make any sense anymore,
mm-hmm.
right? So each time you start the file system, you basically come up with your file system structure looks completely different than what it was the previous time you mounted the file system, right? So that's, I mean, I'm not saying that's bad or anything. I think the problem really is that to get all this into an actual file system, the complexity of the file system is going to be multiplied by a factor, if not an order of magnitude. So because you are talking about making your file system extremely complex by adding all these optimizations inside the file system and in different components of the file system, right? And your space allocation now needs to talk to the journaling mechanism because
the
journaling space is
they
not...
They merge the space allocation table, block allocation table with their journaling.
That's what I'm saying. So earlier, that was completely separate. Your file system was doing file allocation and the journaling did not have to deal with that at all. Now your journaling must be aware of which files are allocated and there has to be, so you're adding some overheads there. If your journal is allocated in between, let's say a large file which has only been filled up halfway, then your file is going to get fragmented because it's interspersed with a journal entry. So again, may not be bad, but really you're adding to the complexity of the system, and in the end, the true performance of all these effects can only be justified with an actual implementation and evaluation.
An actual benchmark running.
Right, so the question is, well, you have all these ideas which seem, you know, if you take one at a time, seem quite novel, right? Quite brilliant, actually. But then, how do they interplay? I mean, are they all complementary? Which one is actually the most important? Can you reduce the complexity of adding all of these all of these ideas by choosing only the most important ones? Let's say choosing one or two ideas and getting that into an implementation which will be more easily accepted by people in the community, and specifically by, let's say, you know, Linux community that who may want to implement your techniques. So yeah, those were my concerns, and the other problem was just in the reading of the paper. There were just so many terms that were not introduced and directly used right away. No use is basically declared before use
problem. And so the other thing is that, I mean, I really could not understand some of these techniques, for instance. I understand them at a high level, but I do not understand how they're implemented at the detail level because of the problem of presentation. So, those are some of my problems. And actually, my rating is for this is a weak reject. Because this paper has a lot of value, but it needs to be substantially improved in many respects. One, the first and most important is presentation. The reader needs to understand what you're doing very clearly, and that did not come across. I mean, I had a lot of questions how these various optimizations are being realized. Second is the validation of these ideas and specifying which ideas are more important than others and which should be focused on by the research community. So I don't know, Sajeev, what did you think about the writing of the paper? I mean,
it's hard. So I think it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Reading is really
hard. Yes.
I mean, could you understand the details of the various techniques? I mean, how they actually
I think
made
after reading 2-3 times.
Yeah.
More than that, I guess. Some of the papers.
Yeah. So what you might want to list in your review is that aspect of the problem, because that's a serious problem. If the reader cannot understand what's
patient
written in
the some concepts in CMAP data structure and some in tree import.
So what I would ask you to do is to revise your review to maybe, you know, 4 or 5 different concepts that you could not understand well and the related terms that were not explained well. Say, well, how is this happening? It's not clear to me. And so on. Because that will really help the authors.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like you really want this paper to get published, right? But if it were to be published, they need to address all of these problems. And you have to help them to address, you know, to at least realize what the problems are.
Okay.
So I would ask you to revise your review and make it more detailed. Talk about all those improvements that should be made. And they certainly need to be made. I will be surprised if everyone agrees to accept this paper. You know, I think for people in the research community, the readability of a paper is foremost. If you cannot read the paper and not understand everything in the paper, then regardless of how brilliant the ideas are, the paper is not going to be.
In that regard, I think the paper from MIT, the record of presenter works.
Which one?
Okay.
So that was a really complicated paper. Yeah, but it did. Yeah, those are guys from MIT, so you really cannot question them. But anyway, I need to go now. But thanks a lot for all the. So I guess if you need to make any revisions of your review, please go ahead and do that. But primarily, the scribes should add the comments that we discussed.
Next week, I think I'm not going to be able to review both, so probably the first one, because I have 2 exams and a project.
So you have 2 papers to review?
Well, I mean, 1 primary and 1 secondary, so probably a secondary I'm not going to be able to
okay.
completely
so
review.
Yeah, I can take that over.
Okay.
I can do that. Okay, so which one do you want me to do? Oh, you have only 1 secondary.
Yeah, right?
Okay, so I'll take that. All right. Okay. So we meet again same time.
I won't be here next Thursday.
Oh, you won't be here next Thursday?
No.
Okay. So this is the...
The conference at
least. Okay. Okay. So when do you leave? So do you want to do this on Tuesday instead? Or is that worse for everyone? Tuesday.
Hey, it's okay.
It depends on if everyone else is okay, then we could do it.
Yeah, I guess.
Tuesday 1 p.m.?
Tuesday 1
p.m.
Okay, let's do Tuesday 1 p.m., so which means that the secondary reviews have to be finished on Monday, which I think is
okay.
A little bit
primary.
You can finish the primary by Saturday. So.
Let's focus the primary to be done by Saturday, so everyone has 2 days to do the secondary.
I see the second paper I'm reviewing for primary review is from Carnegie Mellon. It's from the Gamble group.
How do you know?
You shouldn't know. So you will be biased. See how Ricardo was biased?
How do you know that?
Google.
Oh.
That's evil, man.
Yeah, so ideally the reviewers are not supposed to do Google on file papers, on file names of papers, so...
And now you tell it to everyone, so everyone is fine.
But yeah, but that's fine, I mean, it cannot be avoided. So, I'm going to... Okay, yeah, it's still recording, so...